Not everything that happens in Las Vegas stays in Vegas. This decision opens the door for legal sports betting nationwide.
Yeah, but that's not why Progressive should be happy about it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I'll explain.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on KYAQ on the Central Coast, and Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, and in Round Mountain, California on KKRN, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth, 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. And there is plenty to be, to feel pretty good about today for a change on today's show.
Oh, yay. I like days like that.
You won't have to, feel like you need to throw yourself over a bridge after listening to today's show. I may want to, but you don't need to. It was primary election day on Tuesday in Idaho, Oregon, Nebraska, and the great state of Pennsylvania. Where we have been warning for, Desi Doyen, about 15 years now?
Oh, give or take.
About the horrible 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, which voters across most of that state are still forced to use if they wish to participate in their own elections. As we have noted for an absurdly long time, to little avail. Aside from those systems being 100% unverifiable, their use means that when those touchscreens break down, unlike with hand-marked paper ballots, when those touchscreens break down, voters cannot vote. And so, like clockwork, what do you know? For voters at Lion's Pride Restaurant in York Township, Pennsylvania on Tuesday, according to Fox 43, many voters were none too happy after they were told that voting machine card readers were down for about an hour as polls opened in the morning during rush hour before work. The machines weren't up and running until around 7:30 a.m., said Glenn Smith, solicitor of York County Board of Elections. He said, "We had provisional ballots there. However, it's been policy that we have 10 per party at each of the precincts."
That's all?
Yep. Unfortunately, he says there were more than 10 people for each of the parties that were there. So the incident caused issues for more than 20 people, some of whom work outside of York County and could not make it back in order to vote. Yes, those voters were disenfranchised. Don't throw yourself over that bridge yet. This is the darkest part. Things are going to get better from here, I promise. Emmy Frost, a campaign volunteer, said, "It was very frustrating. I felt bad for people because they couldn't vote. They had places to be. Some people actually drove here from Maryland and then had to go back to work." One York Township voter said, "It was a little disappointing. We just thought we would get this done early because I had an appointment and we wanted to get all of this done before the rain came. And boy, howdy, Did the rain come to the East Coast?
Oh, yeah. It's been an incredibly intense storm slamming the Northeast right now.
Speaking of things that you have been warning about for
yes.
some 15 years, as for those folks who weren't able to make it back by the 8 p.m. deadline to vote on Tuesday in York County, Pennsylvania, Glenn Smith with the York County Board of Elections said they tried to do everything that they could to correct the situation. He said, what we are able to do is identify a polling place that is located close to where the person is so that if they need to, they can go vote at a different polling location, said Smith.
Well, that's not everything they could do.
Well, yeah, because you know what would have been easier? Providing enough goddamn emergency paper ballots for all voters, as election integrity folks have been begging Pennsylvania to do for years. Even, by the way, under their previous Democratic Secretary of State who went to court to fight against that crazy idea. Of course, now I want to throw myself over a bridge. Of course, as we've also discussed for a long time, plans to replace such machines in states like Pennsylvania and Georgia and Tennessee and many other states who are in the process of purchasing new computer voting systems because they think that new computer systems are much more secure than older ones. Many of those states and counties, including here in Los Angeles County, the largest voting jurisdiction in the world, or in the nation at least, many of those places are moving to systems that they call paper ballot systems, but they're actually computer ballot marking devices that will similarly force voters to use a touchscreen in order to print out a computer-marked paper ballot that is then counted by an optical scanner. And yes, when those systems go down, we will have the exact same problem all over the country. Add to that, by the way, those computer-marked paper ballots, not hand-marked, but computer-marked, they can't be known to have been verified as accurate by any voter after an election is done. And most of them trick you into thinking that you are verifying the computer printout, the human-readable portion of it, but in fact, it is the unreadable barcodes on those computer printed ballots that the scanners actually read to tally results. So don't be fooled. No matter how much folks like me yell about this for no matter how many years, it seems like we never learn. So I guess I'll just have to keep yelling. And I hope you will join me. That's much more productive than jumping off a bridge.
True.
More now on the actual reported results of Tuesday's races, whether they are verified or not. As we always warn, you know, these are just the reported results. They are verified by essentially no one at this hour. It often takes days, weeks, months, years. For problems to emerge, as if you didn't hear yesterday's show, you can tune in to find out about what we've learned about an election 2 weeks ago in Tennessee and an election several months ago in, was it Virginia?
Yes.
I think it was Virginia. Yes, it was Virginia, where it looks like the Democrats should, in fact, have taken over the Virginia House of Delegates, but didn't. So go download that at bradblog.com to find out why if you missed it. All right, the biggest story on Tuesday in the primaries in those four states for now was the number of women who ran and did very well, reportedly, in several of the states which held primaries on Tuesday, particularly, yes, in Pennsylvania. As Trip Gabriel at New York Times reports, a state representative, an Air Force veteran, and two high-powered lawyers, all women, won Democratic House primaries on Tuesday in Pennsylvania, where a record number of women ran for House seats in a year of intense political enthusiasm among female Democrats. I wonder why. It was a night of victories for at least seven Democratic women running for the U.S. House in a state that has an all-male congressional delegation of 20 and a state house dominated by male politicians. Yes, there are no women serving in the U.S. House for the great state of Pennsylvania. They also have an all-male statewide representation at the state level for the state offices and in the U.S. Senate. Female candidates showed strength in nearly every region of the state, from the Philadelphia suburbs to the conservative Southwest. Madeline Dean, the state House member, Chrissy Houlihan, the veteran, Mary Gay Scanlon, one of the lawyers, each one in Philadelphia suburban districts that they are now favored to carry in November, according to the AP. Scanlon prevailed in a Democratic primary field that included five other women.
Wow.
The largest number of female Democrats in any congressional primary race in the nation this year, perhaps ever, I might think. Six women running for the nomination. Their primary victories all raise the likelihood of women finally cracking the state's all-male congressional delegation. The women won in districts that were redrawn to replace a gerrymandered Republican map that the state Supreme Court ruled was illegal back in January in the new map of the state's 18 House districts, and the ebullience it set off among Democrats hoping to capture the House of Representatives across the country in the midterms put Pennsylvania front and center among the four states that held the primaries on Tuesday. Trump, President Trump, narrowly won Pennsylvania, you'll recall, in 2016, at least as far as we know. Can't be verified, never was. And in fact, that state will be very critical to determining whether Republicans or Democrats win control of the House in November. Nationwide, Democrats need to flip about two dozen Republican-held seats in order to gain a majority in the House this November. Under the new congressional map in the Keystone State, Democrats have a shot at flipping at least three and possibly as many as six seats this fall. Most in counties around Philadelphia. But the National Republican Congressional Committee, the party's chief spending arm, is not easily seeding those races in those Philadelphia suburbs. The committee has reserved almost $8 million in television advertising for the fall in the Philadelphia market.
Just in Philadelphia. Wow.
And 6 months out, they are already reserving that much time. With that much money in just this one state, and it's actually just for two seats that they're hoping to hang on to. And, you know, we're still 6 months away. That is easily the largest early spending commitment of any region across the country so far. Most of the money, as I say, will be aimed at just two competitive districts north of Philadelphia that are considered to be toss-ups this fall. Both have been Republican-held for a long time, thanks in no small part to the gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. But Democrats think they have a shot at winning those. And it wasn't just women who performed well on Tuesday. So specifically did progressives. A trio of moderate Democrats went down to more liberal opponents on Tuesday night in key House primaries across the country. The latest skirmishes in the battle for the direction of the party, the heart of the Democratic Party, that one national Democrat described to Talking Points Memo as non-ideal outcomes.
Depends on your perspective, I guess.
They were not happy about some of those races, the national Democrats. In the biggest race, the most surprising, really, former Congressman Brad Ashford, Democrat from Nebraska, a so-called moderate who had the support of the national Democrats, including the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, as we call them. Brad Ashford lost to nonprofit healthcare executive Kara Eastman in a stunning race. And it is stunning whenever anyone named Brad loses anything.
Again, depends on your perspective.
But particularly here, it was stunning. Eastman had run hard on universal Medicare for all, and she supports decriminalizing marijuana. Brad Ashford is a former Republican. He basically ran his primary with a general election message touting the work that he'd done as a former congressman to bring a VA clinic back to the district. So Eastman will face off against Republican Congressman Don Bacon in a slightly, in what is considered to be a slightly GOP-leaning district in Omaha. This will be a key test to see if Democrats can, in fact, win by taking strongly progressive positions in swing states. National Democrats are very concerned that Eastman's single-payer views is going to be a tough sell in a GOP-leaning congressional district, and specifically in one where a ton of jobs rely on the medical and insurance industries. Omaha, Nebraska. It's where all the insurance, where all your insurance money goes. While the DCCC congratulated Eastman on her win on Wednesday morning, establishment Democrats, according to Cameron Joseph at TPM, are privately fretting that they may have hurt themselves in what they had considered to be a prime pickup opportunity. Progressive groups, however, counter that Eastman will be able to gin up the Democratic base
a
lot better.
Yeah, so be able to turn them out, because as we've seen previously, you know, Democrats and liberals don't want to vote for Republican light.
That's the theory. We'll find out if that's true in a few months. It's going to be an interesting test for progressives like you, Desi Doyen, who have long made that that claim that the party needs to run farther to the so-called left. Progressive Campaign Change Committee co-head Stephanie Taylor said in a statement that Kara Eastman taught the Democratic establishment a lesson, the way to inspire voters. In 2018 is the campaign on a bold progressive agenda of Medicare for all, higher wages for workers, other economic populist ideas that help working families and challenge corporate power. This, she says, is how Democrats can win in red, purple, and blue districts and maximize a wave in 2018. Well, that may be true in a Democratic primary in a purple district. At least it was true in Omaha on Tuesday night. We'll see if that turns out to be the case in November. Back in Pennsylvania, self-funding philanthropist Scott Walker, Democrat, also defeated Navy veteran Rachel Reddick for the right to run against Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick this fall in a very swingy suburban Philadelphia district. Reddick, like Brad Ashford in Oregon, had previously been a Republican, or as you called them, Republican light. The fact that Wallace made sure that voters knew in his bevy of campaign ads he outspent his opponent there something like 7-1. And she, Rachel Reddick, was supported, again, that former Republican was supported by the National Democrats in the primary. Wallace, by the way, is the grandson of FDR's vice president, Henry Wallace.
Oh, what do you
progressive,
know?
His progressive vice president. Let's see, just to the north of that Philadelphia district in Pennsylvania, a pro-life and anti-immigration Democrat who had repeatedly praised President Trump, he lost.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no kidding. He lost to a more mainstream, although I should say more liberal, more progressive Democratic candidate. This was the Trump-loving Democrat was a Northampton County District Attorney John Morganelli, a foe of so-called sanctuary cities, which we will discuss a bit with my guest in a moment. He had actually applied for a job under Donald Trump.
And he ran as a Democrat.
And he ran as a Democrat. And he had strong local support. He had high name ID, but he lost to former Allentown solicitor Susan Wild, who is a more mainstream liberal who had the support of the pro-choice Emily's List folks. She was not the most progressive candidate in that particular race. There was another local pastor, Greg Edwards, who had the backing of Bernie Sanders. He finished a very close third place. But the combined vote showed how little appetite there is for a Trump apologist in today's Democratic Party. Oh, you think? So it was a mixed bag at best for national Democrats, at least from their point of view, from the point of view of the National Party leadership as they look to retake the House, though very encouraging for those who believe that the party needs to become more progressive. So we will see. Women. So that means women did well. Progressives did well. You know who did not do well?
Who?
Members of Congress. Specifically, NBC calls them members of Congress. They don't specifically mention Republican members of Congress in particular. They're the ones who really had the most trouble on Tuesday. They write, it's not a benefit to be a member of Congress or a former member. They note, without mentioning, that almost all of the folks that they cite who lost were Republicans. They just couldn't mention that. They just say, oh, it's, being a member of Congress is no good. Being a Republican member of Congress particularly is no good. They note that after last week's primaries in four different states, they observed that those with the title of congressman lost, citing Luke Messer and Todd Rokita, both Republican members of Congress in Indiana. Evan Jenkins, a Republican congressman in West Virginia, he lost in his primary bid for the U.S. Senate nomination to run against Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. Speaking of Republican light, Joe Manchin there. And incumbent Republican Congressman Rob Pittenger was ousted, was turfed out. He lost in his primary bid to retain his own seat in North Carolina to an even Trumpier Baptist minister who challenged him. So what happened last night? Well, another congressman, Republican Raul Labrador, lost in the GOP primary for the race for Idaho governor. Another current congressman, Lou Barletta, underperformed, did win, but barely, ended up underperforming in winning Pennsylvania's GOP Senate primary, barely taking the nod to face off against Democratic Senator Bob Casey and a former ex-congressman, that would be Brad Ashford, who I mentioned. He lost in Nebraska. Yes, he's running as a Democrat, but he's a former Republican. They do cite the problems that the GOP appears to be having in Pennsylvania, however, noting that Republicans are not showing strength there. 2 years after Trump shocked the political world by supposedly winning Pennsylvania in the general election, the GOP does not look very strong, at least based on last night's raw numbers in a number of races. In the competitive GOP Senate primary, between Barletta and James Christiana, that GOP primary got fewer votes, about 680,000, than incumbent Democratic Senator Bob Casey did, and he was running unopposed. So,
not a whole lot of enthusiasm there.
No, it doesn't seem. He running unopposed, he got 743,000 votes. So that's not a good sign for Republicans, at least for that seat in Pennsylvania. More Democrats than Republicans turned out to vote in the primary in Pennsylvania's first U.S. House district and in Pennsylvania's seventh House district, both of which are thought to be competitive general election races in November. And yet the enthusiasm by Democrats far outpaced the Republicans. And finally, they note, by the way, NBC News, that it wasn't just progressives in the Democratic Party who did well on Tuesday. Two members of Pittsburgh's chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America defeated incumbent Democratic state representatives in Pennsylvania. So there's that. So there's a few things for women and for Democrats and progressives to feel good about following Tuesday's primaries. We will see if that pattern continues next Tuesday when voters in Arkansas, Georgia, oh, Georgia, 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting system still in place there, Kentucky and Texas, also where they have a bunch of unverifiable voting systems. They all head to the polls again next week. Texas held their primaries already in March, but in more than 30 races, no candidate drew more than 50% of the vote. So they will have runoffs between the top two candidates in each party that came in first and second. That's next Tuesday. So, hey, a reminder, you folks in Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, Texas, and everywhere else, are you registered to vote? Have you checked lately? Now's a good time to do that rather than waiting for a surprise at the polls on Election Day. Just saying. All right, speaking of happy progressives, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back to discuss a U.S. Supreme Court decision earlier this week written by the far-right Justice Sam Alito, but largely concurred with by the court's liberals as well, all of which, at least for now, has made progressives very happy this week for a brief change from this stolen U.S. Supreme Court. That case ostensibly is about sports betting, but that's not why progressives are happy about the ruling. I will explain with my guest Ian Millhiser of Think Progress Justice. Next on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to your broadcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, believe it or not, this week, we've got what progressive watchers of the Republicans' stolen U.S. Supreme Court are describing as very, very, very good news, it seems, from the U.S. Supreme Court. Interestingly enough, those progressives are lauding an opinion, affirmatively lauding this opinion by the court on federalism and, yes, states' rights. And even more interestingly, the majority opinion in the case was written by far right-wing Justice Samuel Alito. What's going on here? Bedfellows getting stranger and stranger in the Trump era, it seems. But it's not the specific case that those progressives are really so happy about, but what it means for a number of other issues and cases likely to come before the court in the Trump era, in an opinion that Trump, whether he realizes it or not, will not likely make him very happy. On Monday, as legal reporter Mark Joseph Stern reports over at Slate, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a federal law that effectively prohibited sports betting in most states. Its decision is most obviously a victory for every state except Nevada, Stern writes, whose monopoly on legal sports gambling will soon be busted by competitors rushing to enter the huge multi-billion-dollar market. But it's also a triumph for federalism, he says, as it imposes reasonable limits on the federal government's ability to strong-arm states into enforcing laws that they would rather repeal. At Think Progress, Ian Millhiser reports the Supreme Court struck down a federal law on Monday that effectively prevented the state of New Jersey from legalizing sports betting, which the state has been trying to do for their Atlantic City casinos now for many, many years. Though the court's decision in Murphy v. NCAA produced some disagreement about how much of this federal law needs to be excised, no justice on the court rose to the statute's defense, writes Millhiser. Indeed, the opinion issued in Murphy was a fairly straightforward application of a doctrine the Supreme Court devised back in 1992. Justice Samuel Alito's majority opinion contains few surprises, writes Ian, for anyone familiar with the court's approach to the balance of power between the federal government and the states. The federal law at issue in Murphy was poorly drafted, he says, and seemed designed to run afoul of a long-standing states' rights doctrine. That doctrine, moreover, as again confirmed by Alito in his opinion and really by the entirety of the court, both left and right this week, has implications well beyond the realm of sports betting. The court's ruling, argue both Millhiser and Stern, isn't simply good news for Atlantic City. It also bolsters the legal case against a number of issues long fought by the right, from the legalization of marijuana to physician-assisted suicide to, very specifically, the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration and, yes, so-called sanctuary cities. Joining us now to explain why this ruling matters far beyond sports gambling and is seen as very good news even though it was brought to us by Sam Alito, is constitutional law and Supreme Court expert and author Ian Millhiser, who serves as the long-toiling editor of Think Progress Justice and as the author of the book Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian Millhiser, sir, welcome back to the broadcast.
Good to be back. Thanks so much.
You bet. I want to discuss why folks like you, of all people, and Mark Stern over at Slate appear to be simply giddy about this ruling authored by Sam Alito, of all people, momentarily, and why you see this as much bigger than simply about sports betting. But on Tuesday, right, very quickly, former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort received what you described to Think Progress as very bad news from a federal court in one of the two federal court cases where he's facing dozens of criminal indictments brought by special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Team Trump and their alleged coordination with Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign. So what was that very bad news for Paul Manafort in federal court on Tuesday?
Well, so the bad news is that he's not going to get rid of York. So the issue here, and it was always a Hail Mary that he was throwing, this is this somewhat needlessly complex case where Manafort's actually facing charges in two different federal courts, mm-hmm. one in D.C. and one in Virginia. And in both courts, he claimed that Mueller doesn't have the authority to prosecute him, that it has to be a regular DOJ prosecutor, not the special prosecutor, if they're going to prosecute these crimes.
The argument being basically that that Robert Mueller doesn't have the mandate in his special counsel statute to actually bring the specific charges that he's bringing against Manafort?
That's right. So the charges against Manafort arise from Manafort's dealings with the Russia-friendly government and the Russia-friendly party in Ukraine. And Mueller's authority extends to Trump campaign officials who had dealings with Russia, among other things. And his argument was basically, well, this isn't close enough to that. This doesn't fit within the special counsel's authority. And one of the two judges hearing these cases just said, no. This is the Russia-friendly party. You know, this was basically a cat's paw for the Russian government. Of course this counts. And then she also gave a few other reasons, among other things, like the regulations that deal with the appointment of a special counsel don't allow people to challenge a special counsel's appointment in court anyway. So it was a nonsense theory that he was arguing. One of the two judges has rejected it. The other judge apparently asked some tough questions from Mueller's attorneys at an earlier hearing. Mm-hmm. He has a reputation sometimes for being hard on the party that he plans to rule in favor of, so I don't know if that means much. But, you know, Trump at least was celebrating the fact that this one judge asked a few tough questions, and now, you know, the other judge has said that Manafort doesn't have a leg to stand on here. I expect the second judge is likely to say the same soon.
And that was the other judge was the one who was appeared to reprimand the prosecutors for bringing the case against Manafort, essentially charging the prosecutors were only doing so in order to get to Trump. And then Trump tweeted about it and talked about it at his at that NRA rally he spoke about, calling it evidence that this was a phony Russia witch hunt. So can that other federal judge still find in favor of Manafort and toss out the case on the basis that the charges go afield of Mueller's mandate here if he wants?
I mean, conceivably he could, although that would have a limited effect because the charges in the D.C. court would still go forward. I don't think this judge is likely to do that, though. I mean, the law here is really clear. There's an appeals court precedent that, like, makes it even more clear that this isn't something that Manafort should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, like, I mean, I think reprimand is a bit too strong of a word. I mean, the judge asked questions. You know, he wanted to be clear about what the law is, which mm-hmm. is something that good judges do. And, you know, I would be very surprised if the judge were to challenge Mueller's authority. And even if this judge were to challenge Mueller's authority, and even if that was upheld then by, you know, higher court,
mm-hmm.
the only impact of it doesn't mean that Manafort gets off. It just means that instead of being prosecuted by Robert Mueller, he's prosecuted by a regular prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's office. So it doesn't actually matter all that much.
And by the way, why aren't those two different sets of indictments that Manafort is facing, why aren't they combined into a single court case in federal court rather than having to force him to fight two separate court cases at the same time?
I mean, it is odd. I mean, what I think is going on here is that so one case is in D.C., one case is in Virginia, and it happens fairly frequently that you have someone who commits crimes in multiple jurisdictions that ordinarily would be prosecuted in multiple courts. And normally what happens in those cases is the prosecutors and the defense counsel just agree amongst themselves that, hey, it's a pain to have two, three, seven, however many trials going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Let's consolidate all these cases. We'll agree to have this in one court, and that'll just make it simpler for everyone.
Yeah.
And Manafort just wouldn't agree to that. I suspect the reason he wouldn't agree with that is because, you know, he's playing political games here.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason why he filed this motion isn't because he thinks he's going to win. It's because on the off chance that he does win, then, like, he gets some good headlines that he can use to try to win the political fight.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, even when the judge asked some questions, you know, that became a big news story that, you know, that Trump was talking about.
Right.
So there's some political logic to it, because the more trials you have going on, the more opportunities you have for, like, a brief news cycle that looks good for Team Trump.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that the outcome's going to be any different.
I got you. I hadn't realized, because I was thinking, you know, as a defendant, it would be easier to have it in one court rather than having to fight two separate cases in two separate courts. But I didn't realize it was Manafort himself who was keeping it that way, seemingly. Okay, on this sports gambling law, for a start, let's start. What is the federal, what is it called, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, or PASPA? It was passed by Congress in 92, struck down by all of the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court this week in Murphy v. NCAA.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, everything about this case is a little weird, including the court's vote. There are only actually six votes to strike it down, although the three in dissent didn't say that it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a very poorly drafted law. Congress has the power to ban sports betting if it wants to. Like, it could just pass a law saying that it's illegal to bet on a sports game. And if, you know, the federal government wants to enforce that law, they could use federal law enforcement, or they could authorize suits in federal court, and that would be the end of it. This law doesn't do that, though. What this law does is it says that states, with the exception of Nevada, aren't allowed to pass their own laws authorizing casino or authorizing sports betting. So instead of just banning sports betting outright, which is totally constitutional, it orders the states not to allow it. And what the Supreme Court said in its opinion is, it's an application of something called the anti-commandeering doctrine, which basically says that the federal government isn't allowed to order the state to do something. And the court said, I think, you know, fairly sensibly here, look, this is the court ordering state legislatures, in this case, not to do something.
Right.
That's not allowed. If Congress wants to ban something, they just need to go ahead and ban it. And so this poorly drafted law was struck down for that reason.
So in other words, when it was passed in, I guess, 1992, and sports betting was already legal in Nevada, but not in these other states. And this federal law basically said state legislatures cannot change their law at this point regarding sports betting, which meant that Nevada got to keep theirs and nobody else got to change their law to make it legal to bet on sports. Is that essentially what the court determined here?
More or less. I mean, I think it's still, like, if Nevada wanted to outlaw sports betting, it still could.
Mm-hmm.
But it said that, like, yeah, it essentially said states can't change their own law.
Okay.
And what the Supreme Court said is that you just can't, Congress can't write a statute that way. You know, if they want to achieve the same goal, they could have just banned sports betting. I mean, potentially they could have even banned sports betting everywhere except in Nevada, although, like, that in and of itself might have, that might create different problems.
Mm-hmm.
But what they can't do is they can't order, they can't tell a state legislature how to do its job.
I gotcha.
And so
in that case, I mean, if a state wanted to pass a law and it was unconstitutional, or if the federal government objected to it, federal government could pass a law that would apply to all 50 states, or it could be challenged in court as far as its constitutionality. But other than that, the federal government, under this federalism premise, cannot tell a state one way or another what they can pass or not pass as a law.
That's right. And to be clear, so there's another doctrine called preemption,
mm-hmm.
which says that federal law is the supreme law of the land, and if there's a conflict between a federal law and a state law, the federal law triumphs.
Mm-hmm.
So if Congress passes a law saying, you know, we hereby ban all sports betting, and mm-hmm. New Jersey passes a law saying we hereby allow sports betting,
mm-hmm.
the federal law would trump the state law. So it's not like states have gained some new special power
right.
to tell the federal government what to do here. I mean, really all that this case is it's saying to Congress, like, next, if you want to pass this law, don't write it in a stupid way. just write the law to say that you're banning sports betting rather than banning states from allowing sports betting.
Okay. Now, with all of that said, I don't actually give a damn one way or another about sports betting. I don't know if
right.
you do either.
Not particularly.
Yeah, but you argue over at Think Progress that this is actually very, very good news above and beyond sports betting. So how will this apply to other issues, as you argue? Specifically, one of the central issues that you focus on in your piece at Think Progress, Ian, is, Trump's immigration crackdown, Jeff Sessions' DOJ battle against so-called sanctuary cities.
Right. So the issue here, so it's important to understand what a sanctuary city is.
Mm-hmm.
So a sanctuary city is this term that someone dreamed up for a city which says our police force will not be used to enforce federal immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, various cities and some states have laws saying that, you know, if there's an undocumented immigrant in detention, that immigrant won't be turned, you know, the police won't turn that person over to ICE.
Mm-hmm.
They won't, like, do record searches to help ICE identify who in their jails are is an undocumented immigrant, things like that.
And to be clear, that's because those local and state police and so forth, they fear that if they start doing that, then people in immigrant communities will no longer talk to police because they'll be turned over, and that will lead to huge crime, immigrant communities then being targeted because they know that they're not going to go to the police. So those are the sanctuary cities the so-called sanctuary cities we're talking about.
Right, yeah, like often law enforcement opposes, like doesn't want to cooperate with
mm-hmm.
ICE because,
right.
you know, if you're trying to solve a burglary
mm-hmm.
and the witness to the burglary is, you know, is undocumented, that person's not going to talk to you if they fear that you're going to go talk to ICE.
And none of those sanctuary cities, by the way, prevent ICE or DHS, et cetera, from coming in and doing their own job if they want, doing their own investigation, coming in and arresting people. It just says, we're not going to use our facilities to help you out to do your job. The state facilities.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So the federal government can enforce its own laws,
right.
you know, whenever it wants to, with its own agents, and it can spend its own money.
Right.
But, you know, this anti-commandeering doctrine is, you know, the same doctrine that was in play in the sports betting case,
mm-hmm.
is it says that the federal government can't order a state to use its own cops and its own resources and spend its own money to enforce a federal law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the federal government wants to deport someone, it has to do it. It has to do it itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I think is you know relevant about this sports betting case. Is like, I mean, the sports betting case. You know, I don't really care that much about
mm-hmm.
betting on sports teams. But it shows that like the court has you know coalesced around this anti-commandeering doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
It shows that, I mean, you know, much of the support for this doctrine is with the court's right flank. And it suggests that when Trump's attack on these so-called sanctuary cities comes up, the Supreme Court's not going to be very friendly to it. And the reason why the Supreme Court is not going to be very friendly to it is because Trump doesn't have the power to order local police to do anything. Local police are only responsible to the state government, maybe their city government, and that's it. If the federal government wants to enforce federal law, it has to use federal officials and federal money to do it.
So he's essentially, your argument here is that when Trump and I guess Jeff Sessions sued the state of California, saying that you must do these things, you can't, your sanctuary state law or whatever it is that was passed out here in California, that you can't do that because we're the federal government and we don't want you to, you can't pass that law. And essentially that's the same as the sports case, telling a state what they can and cannot pass.
That's exactly right. So, California is allowed to decide what laws it has on its own books.
Mm-hmm.
It's allowed to decide what its own police will do. I should note that, this doesn't necessarily help people in red states. Like, Texas is also allowed to decide what it wants to do with its own police. And if Texas decides that it will voluntarily agree to let its police, help ICE out and help out Trump in rounding people up, then, Texas is allowed to choose to help the federal government if it wants to. But what the Constitution provides in this case is that states have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And California can choose not to cooperate with ICE.
Joseph Stern over at Slate argues, for example, that under the Murphy decision at the court this week, Congress could not, for example, pass a law forbidding any more states from legalizing marijuana. So if they suddenly said, okay, there's however many states are allowing it, but we're not going to allow any more, they can't do it. Though if the federal government wanted to, they could still pass a law, attempting anyway, to forbid all legal marijuana sales in all states, correct?
Right. In fact, that law is on the book.
Mm-hmm.
It is still a federal crime to possess marijuana, and I would recommend highly against doing it in front of an FBI agent.
Yes, exactly. Now, progressives are not usually supportive of states' rights arguments taking precedent over federal laws. So are there some issues, Ian Millhiser, where this might work against progressive interests, as you see?
Oh, there are plenty of examples of that. This anti-commandeering doctrine was a creation of conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the first case, applying the law involved an effort to deal with hazardous waste.
Mm-hmm.
The second case involved an effort to regulate guns. So, in the past, this has been something that conservatives love. And my take on it is if the doctrine didn't exist and I was a Supreme Court justice, I wouldn't have been one of the people who voted to create it from nothing, but it's been around for 26 years. It's a workable rule. It hasn't caused that much trouble. There are easy workarounds if you want to work around it. And in this case, it's going to be very helpful in reining in a lot of what Trump wants to do. So, what's sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander here. If Republicans can use this thing to go after gun laws they don't like, then, other people should be able to use it to go after Trump's stupid immigration policy.
Well, there you go. And you got Alito and Kagan both agreeing that this law violates the 10th Amendment. So, I guess we'll take some agreement where we can get it these days. And frankly, Ian, between the coming likely legalization of pot everywhere and now the likely legalization of sports gambling everywhere, those two issues alone, are going to be huge revenue enhancers for states. So I think that even these so-called conservatives should be celebrating this, should be favoring this decision this week so they can, avoid raising taxes on rich people and corporations for a bit longer and take in all that tax money from pot and gambling.
It is a great time for vice taxes.
Yeah, apparently it is. So see, there's something that the right and left can agree on, even in the Trump era. just don't tell Donald Trump because he's not going to like it when it comes to his anti-immigration thuggery. So we'll take that good news where we can get it. It is a very rare moment, so I will take it. Ian Millhiser, thanks for explaining all of this to us today. You can find Ian's work at thinkprogress.org. You can and should follow him on the Twitters at imillhiser. And don't forget to buy his book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian, always great talking with you, my friend.
All right, thanks so much.
You bet. All right, quick break, and we are back with a few more minutes and a few more positive stories. See, I told you, no bridge jumping necessary on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. There was a few more races on Tuesday. I didn't have time to hit them all, but this was, Desi Doyen, I know, of interest to you because this was a woman, which you are, a progressive, which you are, and a Native American, which, as it turns out, you also are.
Well, I descend from, yes. Yeah, this is a really interesting race up in Idaho. Paula Jordan, she's running to be the first Native American governor ever in the United States. She won the Democratic nomination in the Idaho governor race, and she is a two-term state lawmaker from the Coeur d'Alene tribe. She beat out an establishment Democrat on Tuesday night.
Another establishment Democrat
who
went down.
Exactly. So she's going to go up against Republican Lieutenant Governor Brad Little in November. She's another Brad.
Oh, this is another conflict of interest for us here at the Bradcast. I don't know
Brads.
Who to root for now. I have to root against a Brad?
She's only 38 years old. She was running on a very progressive platform, raising the minimum wage, legalizing marijuana, expanding health care, fighting climate change, a big thing for me as well. And in her victory speech on Tuesday, she said, quote, "I didn't win this race by Democrats alone. We won this race by everyone." And she even had endorsements from big progressive national groups like Planned Parenthood, People for the American Way, Democracy for America.
And yet the National Democrats were still against her?
That's right. People for Bernie Sanders, Indivisible. She even got Cher's endorsement.
Oh, well, if Cher is in favor, count me in.
There you go. So, but the Vox.com says that her chances of actually winning are slim.
It's Idaho?
Because it's Idaho, and it's still quite dominated by Republican, rural, and suburban districts.
And that may be, but you know what? This year, count no one out, especially the voters. Count no one out. The voters, if they show up everywhere, including Idaho, well, you know, we're seeing again today in North Carolina, in these red states. On Wednesday, thousands of teachers from across the Tar Heel State, that's North Carolina, they skipped school, they put on red shirts, they marched through North Carolina's capital, demanding a raise, along with more state funding for elections from, for education from lawmakers who say they have been shortchanging public schools for years. In addition to long overdue raises, the teachers want to boost per pupil spending just to meet the national average. They got a shout out from the now Democratic governor of North Carolina, Roy Cooper, who noted that North Carolina is ranked 37th in the country in teacher pay. He said that is unacceptable. The state also ranks 39th in per pupil spending. But, you know, boy howdy, have they been able to give tax breaks to coal companies under their previous Republican governor, Pat McCrory, who just happened to be the CEO of one of the nation's, if not the nation's largest
He was CEO of Duke Energy, which focused on coal.
Imagine that. And so they were able to give, you know, tax breaks to those folks while shortchanging the students. And now the teachers in North Carolina, now they have taken to the streets. They are ticked about it. And this follows what happened in West Virginia earlier this year, where there was a 9-day strike. We saw teachers marching in Arizona, Oklahoma, Kentucky, all so-called red states. So I think You underestimate the mood of the nation at your peril this year, this November, if you just count out states like Idaho because they're, oh, so quote unquote red.
Oh, I agree with you. I think nothing is inevitable. Nothing is set in stone. It's all going to come down to turnout.
So these are not just Republican states, but these are largely women who are hitting the streets, who are furious at their Republican state legislatures.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's all about turnout. I'd say everywhere, everything, everybody is up for grabs this year, or at least it should be. If people register to vote, show up to vote, have their vote counted accurately in a way they know it was counted accurately. So it's a long fight ahead, but I think you'd make a mistake to count any state out at this point. That's one of the reasons I hate calling them red and blue. There are no red and blue states. There are purple states. There are American states. That's what this country is.
Yes, it is.
Don't get me started, or I will throw myself over a bridge. All right, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Ian Millhiser of Think Progress Justice, and to all of you for joining us today. It is always a great honor to have you here. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider stopping by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we do every day over your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com and on the Facebooks and the Twitters, where I hope you will find us, follow us, and share us in every way you can. I am simply The Brad Blog. Is that it?
That's it.
That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.